From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The Pentagon has confirmed that two U.S. bombers flew near artificial Chinese-built islands in the South China Sea in the midst of heightened tensions between Washington and Beijing. According to the U.S. Defense Department, the bombers were contacted and warned by Chinese ground controllers and did not go within 12 nautical miles of any of the Chinese-claimed islands. The U.S. Navy also said it will continue its patrolling mission in the South China Sea. Washington claims the construction of the islands is part of Beijing's efforts to militarize the South China Sea. The dispute between the U.S. and China has heated up in recent weeks over the islands. Beijing had previously warned that it would consider any breach of its territorial waters as dangerous and provocative. China has said that its military is ready to take all necessary measures to respond to any U.S. aggression. Jeff Brown is an expert in U.S.-China relations. Speaking with Press TV Friday, he said that the U.S. posturing over China's island reclamation project is both ineffective and hypocritical.
And the Chinese press, you know, this last 2 weeks, they say, we can't stop the United States from sailing and flying through the Spratly Islands, and they can't stop us building islands and doing what we want to do. I would like to point out to our listeners and viewers out there, there are 52 occupied islands in the Spratlys. 25 are occupied by Vietnam, 10 are occupied by the Philippines, something like 8 or 10 are occupied by Malaysia, several are occupied by Taiwan, and only 8 out of the 52 are actually occupied by China. So it's just rank hypocrisy that the United States is, you know, going through all this bluff and bluster over Chinese occupied islands when they only occupy 8 out of 52 in the area.
In Greece, unions held a general strike against fresh austerity cuts that its creditors have demanded from Athens as a condition for the next bailout payment. The strikers had the support of the country's Syriza government. Press TV's Kanish Fatima spoke with journalist Konstantin Venizelos in Athens Thursday.
Syriza is calling to participate in the protest against the policies that Syriza agreed upon earlier in the summer. The epicenter of today's nationwide industrial action is the consequences, of course, of the latest insurance fund changes and consequences, which is a result of the country's first bailout agreement. And, of course, the recent talks between Greece and its lenders were fruitless over the last few days because Greece and the Portuguese creditors of Greece cannot seem to agree on the newest austerity cuts as regards to non-performing loans, mortgages, and of course home foreclosures. It is astounding today that the first nationwide strike under the Syriza leftist government in the last 11 months, reminding of U.S. Syriza was first elected back in January on a pledge to eradicate austerity policies, but we now see an anti-austerity momentum resurfacing and being reactivated. The factor of social tolerance is, I think, at the moment the most determinant, because Greeks really cannot endure any more wage and pension cuts. They cannot endure or any more healthcare and the national insurance cuts. Really, Greek at the moment are at the end of the tether as regards to relentless austerity policies that did not seem to be surprising anytime soon.
Meanwhile, it appears Greece's Syriza government may no longer be standing alone as it faces the EU and international creditors over austerity. A new leftist government has apparently been formed in Portugal following the ouster of right-wing Portuguese Prime Minister Pedro Passos Coelho by a newly formed left-wing alliance. The new leftist government will rest on a coalition of the anti-capitalist upstart Left Bloc, which soared to a 10% share of the new parliament on a wave of anti-austerity sentiment, along with the socialist and communist parties. The socialists have the largest parliamentary delegation at 32%, and their leader, Antonio Costa, is poised to become prime minister. But although the left bloc and the communists, who grabbed more than 8% of parliament, are both strongly opposed to the EU-imposed austerity that has become extremely unpopular among the electorate, the socialists are not. And that issue had led Costa to form a government last month with the center-right Portuguese alliance, which lasted only 11 days. But the left bloc is hopeful that recent events and the force of popular opinion will cause the socialists to move their position on the issue, and they, along with their Communist Party partners, have leveraged their position in the coalition to get that process moving. Jorge Costa is a newly elected member of parliament for the left bloc. Speaking with Telesur's Cody Weddle Wednesday, he described the contradictions facing the new coalition.
The big lesson from Greece is that no big change, no big political change can be accepted by the neoliberal institutions that lead the European Union nowadays. The consequence for us is that any left-wing government will forcibly have to have a confrontation with Angela Merkel and the leadership of the European Union. The Socialist Party has to make big decisions since it has a large history, as you said, of wrong decisions on the European Union building and on the European treaties that imposed austerity on the people of Europe in the last years. So the deal that was made out by the left-wing parties and the socialists in the last week, it changes large aspects of the Socialist Party program presented to the last election. The changes, as I was saying, in the Socialist Party program impose pensions, welfare pensions, the minimum wage rise, the fight on unemployment, measures on the public health system and education. But we know that these kind of measures, this kind of break with the previous policy of austerity that the right-wing led in the last years, have to face Europe, have to face the big financial interests that lead today's European Union. And so the Socialist Party government will have big political choices to make together with the left-wing parties that are supporting the formation of this new government.
As we reported earlier, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro visited Riyadh this week. He was there as a part of a meeting between UNASUR and the Arab League. Maduro presented a proposal for a new partnership between the two blocs. For more on that, upcoming elections in Argentina, and other news and events in Latin America and the Caribbean, we now go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Tony, welcome. Let's jump right in.
Yeah, thanks, Don. It's been another very busy week with very, very important things happening one way or another, both in the region and also outside the region. And as you pointed out to me, there was so much else going on that I'd forgotten about the very, very important meeting between the UNASUR countries, which is the countries of the Union of South American Nations, and the countries of the Arab League. They had a summit in Riyadh during the week. And at that summit, I was just boning up on that, reading that. Obviously, one of the main things that the oil-producing countries like Ecuador and Venezuela are concerned about is the oil price. And they were pressing for the Arab OPEC countries to reactivate the kind of mechanism that was used in the late 90s, which was essentially a band of prices that enabled OPEC producers to mitigate their differences and agree on a band of prices that actually helped bring up the oil price to a level that was more helpful for the OPEC reducing countries, and extremely important for Venezuela at the time, because at that time Hugo Chavez was just beginning the process of transforming Venezuela into a progressive state run for the benefit of the majority of the people. So that was a very important, I don't know if anything actually positive happened about that. I haven't had time to read the declaration, but that was the proposal.
Yeah, and I want to set that up a little bit for listeners too. What Tony's talking about, first of all, is at this was at the outset of the construction of a new economy in Venezuela, and the oil revenues were a key part of that. The state-owned oil companies' revenues were a key part of that, and oil prices had been depressed, making it more difficult. And that's an analogous situation to the one we face now.
Yeah, and the prices then dropped to, I think they dropped to as low as $10 to $15 for the barrel at that time.
Low, very low.
Extremely low. And so, yeah, it's a big issue, complicated issue for the countries concerned, and let's see what the final result in terms of any agreement might be.
Yeah, and then so the thing that was interesting about it was when he went there, he comes with a proposal. Now, essentially what Chavez did, once they got oil prices to a place where there was positive revenue, he used that to set off the entire process of regional integration that we now see essentially in the form of UNASUR traveling around the world and making deals, and that was with Petrocaribe.
Yeah, so the other very important element, apart from the specific oil price concerns of Ecuador and Venezuela, was that general issue of trade and investment, and how the UNESCO countries are hoping that the Arab countries will invest more and trade more with South America. And one of the proposals at the meeting apparently was to set up a couple of joint companies, one maritime and one aviation company. At that level, which is an extremely innovative concept for those kinds of blocs, for UNASUR and the Arab League countries to be talking about setting up joint companies for maritime and aviation transport is a huge leap in terms of thinking about South-South cooperation.
And even integration. And so what's interesting to me is that it seemed like Maduro was bringing the Petrocaribe model to the Arab League and saying essentially, even to people like Saudi Arabia, look, this model does not is not biased against any particular political system, ideology, nothing. We work with everybody and we allow you your own sovereignty, your own right of self-determination nationally. We do business together and we use the proceeds to help uplift our own peoples. And you can do that too. And this is a model for you to help develop some of the nations around you that need it.
Yeah, and it's fair. I mean, look at countries like Sudan, for example.
Right.
And so, and also in terms of ideology, as you mentioned, as a potential kind of issue in terms of that negotiation, from the point of view of Islam, Petrocaribe is very much in tune with the moral ethos of Islam in terms of trade and finance and so forth.
Right.
So, you know, and that's something that'll be very interesting to see what concrete agreements come out of that. And you can bet your life that the United States and the European Union are doing everything they can to undermine that.
Well, look at the set of oil producing nations. You have OPEC and you have the South American oil producers, both within and without. You also have Brazil, part of UNASUR, that's there, which is within the BRICS countries, which also includes Russia, which is another oil producer. So if there were a Arab League Petrocaribe to develop and that kind of a project flows from it, you're looking at everybody but the U.S. being involved.
Yeah, and another important thing to bear in mind is that Brazil is currently hosting, I'm not sure if it's the Angolan president or the one of the important Angolan political leaders is on a visit to Brazil at the moment, and you can bet your life that they're also talking about South-South cooperation and cooperation around oil and energy generally, oil and gas.
And they're speaking about it in Portuguese.
And they're speaking about it in Portuguese, which I don't read. Do you?
No.
Right. So then the other important thing also involving President Nicolas Maduro was his subsequent visit to Geneva to address the UN Human Rights Council.
Right, and that was quite an address, too. He tore the U.S. A new behind, essentially, there, talking about how the United States and the Europeans use the facade of human rights given their own conditions, and he pointed to the shooting of black teenagers in the streets here as one example, and lecture the rest of the world about it.
Yeah, and coming from the Arab League countries and going into that kind of Geneva, the kind of the administrative managerial home of all that, the human rights NGO industry. And I should imagine that he was very diplomatic, but the implicit image of, or the implicit message that he could very well have made was that, you know, why is the United States criticizing the most democratic country in the world in many ways in Venezuela?
He cited the ways.
While keeping completely silent about the extreme human rights abuses taking place in countries like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain.
And what was interesting is that Saudi Arabia sits on top of a committee there now, the Human Rights Committee.
Right, yeah. So, you know, and that's all kinds of hypocrisies and cynical skullduggery going on. And so it was very important for Nicolas Maduro to go and take that head on. And make the point that Venezuela, apart from being one of the most democratic countries in the world, in terms of social, economic, and cultural rights, is among the world leaders, far ahead of the United States.
That's right, in so many ways. You know, before we get too far away from it, I want to go back to the Dilma Rousseff speaking with whoever's coming from Angola in Portuguese, because of what just happened in Portugal, where they have a left guided government. The socialists are the largest grouping within the new left bloc, with the left bloc, the communists and the socialists, and it's their prime minister that's been selected. And so the socialists, of course, have been going along with the program with austerity, but they've been forced to back off of that position, and now there's a popular mobilization. And so you're looking already at a Syriza-type phenomenon establishing itself, perhaps, in Portugal, and that being support for Syriza as it's starting to battle again with the EU, with its own people in the streets.
Yeah, and I just looked at the report about that Angolan visit to Brazil. It's at the level of foreign ministers. So the Mauro Vieira, the Brazilian foreign minister, is receiving his Angolan counterpart, Jorge Chicote. The reason that they're having that meeting is it's the 40th anniversary of the independent Angola's independence. So even at that level, although it's not the highest level, it's a very important meeting, and there's no doubt at all that the two foreign ministers will be discussing trade and all that stuff. And in Brazil, and I don't know if it's an appropriate moment to start talking about Brazil.
Sure.
And in Brazil right now, there are big demonstrations going on, but this time not against the government, but rather against the head of the Câmara de Deputados, of the legislative chamber in Brazil, a guy called Cunha, who is. He's been one of the leaders trying to promote this kind of, what do you call it, a soft coup against
Rousseff,
Dilma Rousseff, and it turns out that he himself is actually subject to legal proceedings as a result of his relations with Petrobras. I mean, Petrobras is the big state oil company in Brazil,
which they've been trying to tag Rousseff with, and unsuccessfully.
Yeah, and Rousseff and also Ignacio Lula da Silva, her predecessor.
That's right.
The right wing in Brazil have been trying to exploit the issue of corruption that is the issue that currently being used by the United States and its European allies to kind of sow instability in the countries of Latin America, Central America, and South America and the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that this guy Eduardo Cunha himself is facing very, very serious charges. But those get played down by the international media.
And by the Brazilian private press, too.
Yeah, of course. And so what's happening today is that there's a protest that's taking place in some, I think it's come on, 24 of Brazil's states.
Wow.
Against, and it's kind of Cunha out. That's the slogan. Fora Cunha. That's the slogan, and it's great to see that happening.
Yep.
After having got used to the right wing mobilizations against the government of Dilma Rousseff.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that perhaps we should use that to talk about the wider issue of the vulnerability of progressive governments, especially the progressive governments in Latin America, who, unlike the Arab League countries, actually have to deal with real democracy.
That's right. That's right.
And dealing with elections, the election process is well underway in Venezuela now for the legislative elections on December 6th. And of course, in Argentina, they're kind of not far off. We're only about a week away now from the very, very important, some regarded as perhaps the most decisive vote for many, many years in terms of the sustainability of the progressive governments in South America and their ability to maintain momentum for their progressive regional agenda of integration and building a multipolar world at a global level.
Very important, for sure.
So in Argentina, you've got this weekend, the two candidates who will be up for election in the runoff vote on November the 20th, Mauricio Macri and Daniel Scioli. Mauricio Macri, there's been a lot coming out about his background, about his relations with the right wing in Spain, for example, the right wing generally. And somebody wrote an article, I've forgotten who it was, about that nobody had noticed before, about Macri's very close relationship with Álvaro Uribe of Colombia. And that should set, in Argentina, that should set alarm bells going like crazy.
For sure.
Because, you know, in a country that is only, 30 years out of the dictatorship that afflicted Argentina between 1976 and 1983.
That's right.
And during that dictatorship, 30,000 Argentinians were disappeared. And murdered by the military regime, and this regime is the same fascist ideology of Álvaro Uribe in Colombia, who's responsible himself for all kinds of human rights abuses. And it's so ironic that Venezuela should have to, that the leader of Venezuela felt it necessary to go and confront the charges that are being leveled against Venezuela internationally by the United States and its allies, while somebody like Álvaro Uribe enjoys complete immunity in that sense.
And he gets checks too, probably.
Well, sure. and so the fact this report by about Macri's relationship with Uribe pointed out that Macri, while he was mayor of Buenos Aires, actually invited Álvaro Uribe to Buenos Aires and gave him public honors.
Yeah.
There, which is Macri is very, very much playing that down.
Yeah, he longs for the day of the Argentine death squads, but since he didn't have any, he brought a rebate in just so he could bask in the glow, you know.
Right, yeah, and some people might regard that as a too cynical a comment, but I personally think it's a very, very, you know, it does reflect the mentality of the Argentinian right wing. And, you know, the more information that comes out about Macri, it's very, very clear that his agenda is an extreme right-wing agenda. And if the Argentinian electorate vote for him, they're effectively committing political suicide and engaging in a massive step backwards into the days of the Argentinian dictatorship. No, although, you know, it won't look like that to begin with, but that is the mindset that that outright fascist mentality that Macri represents. And what he's done in his campaign is very cleverly dress it up, put cosmetics over it to make himself appear a kind of neocon progressive in that will, you know, I know that's a ridiculous oxymoron, but
no,
you know,
it's true, yeah.
What he's doing is projecting himself as a young candidate for change.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The most important thing, forgetting the mindset, of course, is that he represents the same interests that were expressed during the military dictatorship.
Very much so, Don. And the Argentinian business right wing, the elite interests in Argentina that will immediately throw Argentina back into the arms of the Western financial economy controlled by the IMF, the World Bank, all that stuff.
I'd say the clutches instead of the arms, but yeah.
Yeah, the clutches, right. So then, and by contrast, Daniel Scioli, whatever one may think of him, you know, and there are one of the issues that is a very serious area of discussion in Argentina is what the more left wing, the people to the left of the government of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, what they should do in the election, because historically what happens in these progressive elections, or in these elections whereby the progressive candidate, the broadly progressive candidate, is at risk, is that the more left wing, I don't like using the phrase the extreme left wing, the more left wing, the more radical components of the political scene, in this case Argentina, and they won something, and altogether I think they won about 6 or 7% of the vote in the first round of the elections, and so their vote is extremely important to bolster Daniel Scioli's chances of winning in the runoff on November 20th,
for sure.
But they're saying, well, Scioli isn't radical enough.
Oh, please.
But then, no, I know, and there is that position. Oh, we can't vote for Scioli because he's not radical enough.
Do they not see the larger political context, the larger geopolitical context?
And that's the broad issue, isn't it? And it happens in elections everywhere. But this election is so important to keep the fascist right wing out.
Yep.
And let's see what happens. I firmly believe that Scioli will win, because I think the Argentinian electorate is sufficiently sophisticated to understand what's at stake.
Let's hope that the constituents that elect the more left people and parties into the government, that 6%, let's hope that they're more aware of the geopolitical context also than perhaps the people that they've elected.
Yeah, and in the first round of the presidential elections, and Scioli did come out ahead of Macri, but only by about 3%.
Right.
And about 20% of the vote went to a kind of more middle of the road kind of variety of Peronismo, the main political movement in Argentina that has broken up into many different factions. And another 6 or 7% voted for more radical left-wing groups. So it's not that Scioli's battle at the moment, prior to this second round of the presidential elections, is to convince those people in this middle of the road,
right,
Peronist movement,
right,
that voting for Macri would be both against their fundamental political principles, but also taking Argentina backwards. And I think that he'll win that. And he'll win that struggle. And one of the crucial events in it will be this Sunday. He and Macri have a televised debate.
Right.
And the
election is next Saturday, is that right?
It's November the 20th.
Oh, that's next Friday. Okay. Well, we're going to watch that, and I guess we can't talk about the outcome then, but we can certainly look at how things appear next week when we speak again. Tony, thanks a lot. Sure. Pleasure.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Thanks a million.
And that's all the news we have for you right now.
For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.